Time signal. 40 seconds before 11 o'clock. Christmas shopping's an adventure at Bullock's 101 Christmas Gift Shop. Visit the Gift Bazaar, a street of light, the toy parade, the floor of furniture gifts, and Bullock's other 101 Christmas Gift Shop. Broadway Hill and 7th, shop now. Only 21 shopping days to Christmas. KMTR, Hollywood. Through the courtesy of KHJ and the Donnelly facilities, KMTR has the pleasure of presenting President Roosevelt's address before an audience of Georgians at Atlanta.
The state of Georgia celebrates its homecoming. Ladies and gentlemen, from Grant Field, the great horseshoe stadium of famed Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia, Columbia presents the dramatic spectacle of the Southland welcoming the President of the United States. From the red clay hills and the wide sand plains of this empire state of the South, and from all Dixie, the thousands on end have pushed their way into a gay Atlanta, splashed with the color of many flags and echoing with the drum beats of 100 brass bands. Not since Grover Cleveland stood in the Piedmont Exposition here has a Democratic president visited Atlanta. And so today this homecoming is a vast demonstration, perhaps half a million strong, swept away in a roaring tidal wave of enthusiasm. Signs, banners, uniforms, badges, gold braid and scarlet coats, the greatest crowd ever assembled in the South. And all engulfed in an ocean of noise, 10 Thanksgiving football homecomings put together. Thus to the people of Georgia, welcome Franklin Delano Roosevelt to his other state. Up from Warm Springs, some 70 miles to the south, in a long, fast motorcade, the president is driven to Fort McPherson Army Post as the cannon roared and flashed. Paraded through the streets of this capital city, halted at Piedmont Park as 100,000 school children saluting the flag sang America. Outside the white walls of Grant Field, the president paused to press an electric button, unveiling a plaque 200 feet away on one of the red brick apartment buildings of the first of the low-rent housing slum clearance projects undertaken by the government. And now, as the 7 or 8 masked bands that completely lost count of them played Hail to the Chief, played the Stars and Stripes Forever, the President of the United States, accompanied by the official party, the host, the congressional delegation of 10, the governors of 6 states, has entered the stadium, Grant Field, and is about to speak to this huge crowd assembled, the greatest ever assembled in the South.
My friends and neighbors. I do not need to tell you that I am happy to be in Georgia, nor do I need to tell you that I am proud of Georgia. Happy especially today because of this moving reception which my friends, the senators, and all of the representatives in the Congress from this state have tendered me, and which you, the good people of this state, have responded to with such warmth and hospitality. Happy because I meet again so many old friends and neighbors. Proud because I see signs on every hand that the overwhelming majority of the people of this state are keeping pace with millions of others throughout the nation who believe in progress, are willing to work for progress, and are going to get progress. Proud, too, because I see clear signs of a revival of material prosperity in country and in city, and especially because I sense a swelling prosperity of the spirit that spells a greater help and a deeper happiness for our fellow men. 11 years ago, I came to live at Warm Springs for the first time. That was a period of great so-called prosperity. But, my friends, I would not go back to the conditions of 1924. And I do not believe that you people would want to go back to those conditions either. Of that year, and of the 5 years that followed it, I have a somewhat clear recollection, which you can verify for yourselves. In that orgy of prosperity, a wild speculation was building speculative profits for the speculators and preparing the way for you, the public, to be left holding the bag. In that orgy of prosperity, banks, individually and by chains, were closing their doors at the expense of the depositors. In that orgy of prosperity, the farmers of the South had become involuntary speculators themselves, never certain when they planted their cotton whether it would bring 25 cents or 15 cents or a nickel. In that orgy of prosperity, the poorest vied with the richest in throwing their earnings and their savings into a cauldron of land and stock speculation. In that orgy of prosperity, slum conditions went unheeded. Better education was neglected. Usurious interest rates mounted. Child labor continued. Starvation wages were too often the rule instead of the exception. Yes, in those days, mammon ruled America. And that's why we're not going back to them. Those are the years for us to remember in the future. Those fool's paradise years before the crash came. Too much do we harp on the years that followed, when from 1929 to 1933, this whole nation slipped spirally downward, ever downward to the inevitable point when the mechanics of civilization came to a dead stop on March 3rd, 1933. You and I need not rehearse the 4 years of disaster and gloom. We know the simple fact that at the end of those 4 years, America acted before it was too late. America turned about, and by a supreme, well-nigh unanimous national effort, started on the upward path again. You and I have reason to remember the past 2.5 years that have gone by so quickly, reason to remember the fine spirit of the average American citizenship, which made my task vastly lighter. Memory is short, but yours is not too short to recollect, for example, those great meetings of the representatives of the farmers of the nation, regionally and in Washington, in the spring and summer of 1933, when they agreed overwhelmingly that unfairly low prices for farm crops could never be raised to and maintained at a reasonable level until and unless the government of the United States acted to help them to reduce the tremendous carryovers and surpluses that threatened us and the whole world. You and I can well remember the overwhelming demand that the national government come to the rescue of the homeowners and farm owners of the nation who are losing the roofs over their heads through inflated valuations and exorbitant rates of interest. You and I still recollect the need for and the successful attainment of a banking policy which not only opened the closed banks, but guaranteed the deposits of the depositors of the nation. And you and I have not forgotten the enthusiastic support that succeeded, and still I'm glad to say in large part succeeds, in ending the labor of children in mills and factories, in seeking a fairer wage level for those on starvation pay, and in giving to the workers hope for the right collectively to bargain with their employers. You and I will not forget the long struggle to put an end to the indiscriminate distribution of fly-by-night securities and to provide fair regulation of the stock exchanges and of the great interstate public utility companies of our country. You and I, yes, every individual and every family in the whole land are being brought close to that supreme achievement of this great Congress, the Social Security Law, which in the days to come will provide the aged against distressing want, will set up a national system of insurance for the unemployed, and will extend well-merited care to sick and crippled children. You and I are enlisted today in a great crusade in every part of the land to cooperate with nature and not to fight nature. To cooperate to stop destructive floods, to prevent dust storms, to prevent the washing away of our precious soils, to grow trees, to give thousands of farm families a chance to live, and to seek to provide more and better food for the city dwellers of the nation. In this connection, my friends, I think it is of interest to tell you a story, to point out that national surveys that have been conducted in the past year or two prove that the average of the citizenship of the United States lives today on what our friends the doctors would call a third-class diet. If the country lived instead of on a third-class diet, only on a second-class diet, you know what that would mean? It would mean that we would need to put back many more acres than we use today to put them back into the consumption of foodstuffs for domestic consumption. And if the nation lived as I wish it did on a first-class diet, we'd have to put more acres than we've ever cultivated into the production of an additional supply for Americans to eat. That raises a question. Why, speaking in broad terms, in following up this particular illustration, why are we living on a third-class diet. Well, the best answer I know is this. For the very simple reason that the masses of the American people have not got the purchasing power to eat more and better food. I mentioned a few weeks ago that farm income in the United States has risen since 1932, a total of nearly $3 billion. That's because wheat is selling at better than 90 cents instead of at 32 cents. That corn is selling at 50 cents instead of 12 cents. And that cotton is at 12 cents instead of 4.5 cents. And I wonder what cotton would be selling at today if during these past 3 years we had continued to produce 15 or 16 or 17 million bales each year, adding to our own surplus, adding to the world's surplus, and driving the cotton farmers of the Southland into bankruptcy and starvation. But what does this additional $3 billion of farmers' income mean to the country? What does it mean to the dwellers in the city? It has meant the rebirth of city business, the reopening of closed factories, the doubling of automobile production, the improvement of transportation, and the giving of new employment to millions of Americans. That brings me squarely face to face, and you too, with the fact of the continued unemployment of many millions of people, of whom approximately 3.5 million are employable people, but people who can't get jobs and are in need of relief. When some of the people of a great and wealthy country are suffering from starvation, I take it that no honest government has a choice. Nearly 3 years ago, realizing in the beginning that we were not doing a perfect thing, but that we were doing a necessary saving and human thing, we appropriated money for direct relief. That was necessary, as you and I know, to ward off actual starvation. But just as quickly as possible, we turned to the job of providing actual work for those in need. I realize that gentlemen in well-warmed and well-stocked clubhouses will discourse on the expenses of government and the suffering that they are going through because their government is spending money for work relief. I could take some of these gentlemen out on the battle line of human necessity and show them the facts that we in the government are facing. If these more fortunate Americans will come with me, I will show them not only the necessity for the expenditures of this government, but I will show them as well the definite and beneficial results that we have attained with the dollars we have spent. And And some of these same gentlemen tell me that a dole would be more economical than a work relief. That's true. But the men who tell me that have unfortunately too little contact with the true America to realize that in this business of relief, we are dealing with properly self-respecting Americans, to whom a mere dole outrages every instinct of individual independence. I believe that most Americans want to give something for what they get. And that's something which in this case is honest work is the saving barrier between them and moral disintegration. I propose to build that barrier high and keep it high. Let me talk to you some more about money. Last April, I stated to the Congress what I have held to consistently ever since, that it was the hope of the administration that by sometime in November of this year, we would substantially end the dole and offer in place of it employment to by far the greater part of the 3.5 million employable persons that we estimated were on relief rolls in the United States. Week after week, from that time on, some individuals and some organizations and some groups, careless of the truth, regardless of scruple, have sought to make the American people believe that this program was a hopeless failure and that it could not possibly succeed. Today is the 29th day of November. 2 days ago, something happened. It gives me a certain satisfaction to be able to inform you, and through you the nation, that 2 days ago, by actual figures, there were 3,125,000 persons at work on a great variety of useful projects in every state in the Union. The small remaining number have received orders to report to work on projects already underway or about to be started. That result, my friends, I believe you will agree with me, constitutes a substantial and successful national achievement. Aside from the tremendous increase in morale through substituting work for a dole, there's the practical side of permanent material benefit. Within sight of us, just around the corner, stands you see, now we know how to go around the corner. There stands a tribute to useful work under government supervision, the first slum clearance and low-rent housing project. Here, at the request of the citizens of Atlanta, we have cleaned out 9 square blocks of antiquated, squalid buildings, for years a detriment to this community. Today, those hopeless old houses are gone, and in their place we see the bright, cheerful buildings of the Peckwood Housing Project. Within a very short time, people who never before could get a decent roof over their heads will live here in reasonable comfort amid healthful, worthwhile surroundings. Others will find similar homes in Atlanta's second slum clearance project, the University Project. And still others will find similar opportunity in nearly all of the older, overcrowded cities of the United States. I take it that it has been equally worthwhile to the nation to give jobs to the unemployed in the construction of a vast network of highways, including thousands of miles of farm-to-market roads, in repairing great numbers of schools, and building hundreds of new schools in city and country, in helping cities to put in sewers and disposal plants and waterworks, in constructing cold storage warehouses, county recreational buildings, in creating aviation fields, in giving 1 million American boys a chance to go to CCC camps and to work on forestry and soil erosion prevention. In controlling malaria, in pushing health projects, in putting white-collar workers into jobs of permanent usefulness to their communities, and last but not least, in giving youth an opportunity for better education. But, my friends, into the ears of many of you have been dinned the cry that your government is piling up an unconscionable and back-breaking debt. Let me tell you a simple story. In the spring of 1933, many of the great bankers of the United States flocked to Washington. They were there to get the help of their government in the saving of their banks from insolvency. To them, I pointed out, in all fairness, the simple fact that you couldn't make bread without flour, the simple fact that the government would be compelled to go heavily into debt for a few years to come in order to save banks and save insurance companies and mortgage companies and railroads and to take care of millions of people who are on the verge of starvation. And every one of these gentlemen expressed to me at that time the firm conviction that it was all well worth the price, and that they heartily approved. But I didn't stop there. In order to get their further judgment, I asked them what they thought the maximum national debt of the United States government could rise to without serious danger to the national credit. Their answers, remember, this is in the spring of 1933, their answers were that the country could safely stand a national debt of between $55 and $70 billion. But I told them that a rise in the national debt to any such figure was, in my judgment, wholly unnecessary. and that even if they, the bankers, were willing, I could not and would not go along with them. I told them then that only a moderate increase in the debt for the next few years seemed likely and justified. That objective holds good today. But remember at the same time that many bankers and big businessmen would have been willing to put the country far deeper into debt than I shall ever let it go. And by way of parenthesis, if the bankers thought the country could stand a debt of $55 to $70 billion in 1933 with values as they were then, I wonder what they would say the country could stand today in the light of an enormous increase of values of property. Let's make one thing clear. Your government, and I say to you, you cannot borrow your way out of debt, but you can invest your way into a sounder future. As a matter of actual fact, the gross national debt under the last administration rose from a little over 17 billions, get that, not millions, to 21 billions. And the day I came into office, I found that the National Treasury contained only $158 million. At the rate of previously authorized expenditures under the last administration, I found enough money in the Treasury to last less than 1 month. Since that time, March 4th, 1933, the national debt has risen. Of course it's risen, and you know why. Risen from 21 billions to 29.5 billions. But it must also be remembered on any comparison that today included in this figure, there is nearly 1.5 billions of working balance in the Treasury of the United States. And nearly $4.5 billion of recoverable assets, which the government is going to get back over a period of years. And as we get it back, we're going to retire the national debt with it. As things stand today, in the light of a definite and continuing economic improvement, we have passed the peak of appropriations. Revenues, without the imposition of new taxes, are increasing. And we can look forward with assurance to a decreasing deficit. The credit of the government is today higher than that of any other great nation in all the world. It is higher in spite of attacks on that credit made by those few individuals and organizations which seek to dictate to the administration and to the Congress how to run the National Treasury and how to let the needy starve. back in that same spring of 1933, if you and I had made a national balance sheet, I mean a balance sheet based on what the individual people of the country owned and owed, we would have found that if we had added up the values of all of the property of every kind in the United States, the total of those values, which you and I would call assets, would have been greatly exceeded by another figure, the figure representing the total of all the debts owed by the people of the United States. In other words, in March 1933, our national balance sheet, the wealth on the one side against the debts of the American public, showed that we were then in the red. Today, 2.5 years later, it is a fact that the total of all the debts in the United States is lower today than it was then. And on the other side of the picture, you and I know that the values of property of all kinds, farms, houses, automobiles, securities, and every other kind of property have increased so greatly since 1933 that today we are once more in the black. We were insolvent. Today we're solvent, and we're going to stay so. In this fact, especially in the fact that we are gathered here today at a time of national thanksgiving, all of us can, I think, rightly find a deep satisfaction. But recovery means something more than getting the country back into the black. You and I do not want just to go back to the past. We want to face the future in the belief that human beings can enjoy more of the good things of life under better conditions than human beings ever enjoyed in the past. American life has improved in these 2 years and a half. And if I have anything to do with it, it's going to improve more in the days to come. That word progress is a better word than recovery, because progress means not only a sound business and a sound agriculture, sound from the material point of view, but it means with equal importance a sound improvement in American life as a result of continuing and forceful effort on the part of the people of our nation, and through them, on the part of the government of the nation. I am certain, my friends, that that is your purpose. You have my assurance that it is mine. And that is why I continue my confidence, my deep, everlasting faith in the people of America.
see you.
The President of the United States puts on his soft gray hat, takes it off, waves, the band plays 60, the handkerchiefs flutter in the breeze, the crowd cheers, and thus comes the climax in true Dixie style of this Georgia homecoming for the President of the United States. Speaking in Grant Field at Georgia Tech, President, barehead, without his overcoat, held the crowd's attention for minutes on end as you heard the entire program over the Columbia Network. The President hasn't left yet, stands on the arm of his son James, smiling at the crowd, waving his hat, and the crowd waves back and cheers back. Seven or eight bands down on the field, the American Legion Band in their blue uniforms, the scarlet capes of the Georgia Tech, University of Georgia Band with the ornate drum leader, waving his baton around, and now a couple of just two enthusiasts.